From the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media, this is Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the science behind weather and climate in Illinois. I'm your host, Steve Nesbitt, in for Maddie Stover this week. I'm the head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. On Tuesday, October 28th, Category 5 Hurricane Melissa made landfall in Jamaica, and on Wednesday, October 29th, it made landfall in Cuba and then the Bahamas.
People across the Northern Caribbean are digging out from the destruction caused by Hurricane Melissa as deaths from the storm have climbed. Emergency relief flights began landing at Jamaica's main international airport as crews worked to reach communities still isolated after they were directly hit by the Category 5 storm.
Tremendous, unprecedented devastation of infrastructure.
Preliminarily, Melissa tied the record for the lowest pressure at landfall in the North Atlantic Basin, with a minimum central pressure of 892 hectopascals, although we're still looking at the impacts that Melissa had as information becomes available. Regardless, Melissa was a strong and devastating storm for portions of the Caribbean.
But we were able to reach Elaine Bradley. She's president of the local Chamber of Commerce in Negril.
So it just carried on right through the night. It was howling, the water pouring in. It was in a movie, really.
What about your neighbors?
My neighbor, his roof went. They were outside their veranda. I'm literally videoing my roof that's blowing away.
To talk more about Hurricane Melissa, we are joined by Deanna Hence and Jeff Frame, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Deanna and Jeff, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be back.
So, Jeff, can you walk us through the timeline of Hurricane Melissa's development?
Sure. Hurricane Melissa, like a lot of hurricanes in the Atlantic, developed from what we call a tropical wave. That is a cluster of thunderstorms that moves westward off the continent of Africa into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, the wave that became Melissa didn't develop immediately like some storms do, but rather it tracked across the Atlantic for over a week. And it wasn't until Tuesday, October 21st, when it was named Tropical Storm Melissa in the Eastern Caribbean Sea. This storm was battling somewhat of a hostile environment at the outset, with some mid-level dry air evaporating some of the cloud cover, and also strong wind shear, or strong winds aloft that tend to rip tropical cyclones apart. However, the environment was forecast to become much more favorable in the days ahead, and the storm began rapidly strengthening, becoming a hurricane on Saturday, October 25th, and continued to rapidly strengthen, becoming a Category 5, that's the strongest classification on the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale, on Monday, October 27th, one day before it made landfall, as you said, in Jamaica on Tuesday, October 28th.
So, Deanna, what made this storm so powerful?
Well, hurricanes rely upon a few different factors to be able to organize themselves into these powerful wind and rain generating systems. The first is that they rely on warm ocean water, both at the surface, but also down into the depths. Additionally, they also rely on humidity, like what Jeff said, and these things help them to create the clouds that then, as that water vapor condenses into rain, help release a lot of energy that they can then turn into wind energy. But the third component that's also really important is what Jeff mentioned in terms of the vertical wind shear. So this is a difference between winds closer to the surface of the ocean versus higher up in the atmosphere. Hurricanes like their clouds to be very vertically stacked so that they can really be the most efficient at releasing that energy. With wind shear, it can start to tilt the storm or even rip it apart. And so a hurricane likes it best if that wind shear is very low. So as Jeff mentioned, at first, those conditions were very unfavorable for that storm to develop and organize. But once it reached the Caribbean, all of those things came together to enable Melissa to organize into a very powerful storm.
Yeah, so Jeff, of course, one of the important ways that we monitor these systems is through what we call reconnaissance aircraft. These are planes that fly out and directly penetrate the storm. And we saw some adventures in monitoring the storm in this way. Can you talk about some of the data that was collected and some of the remarkable things that we saw during this storm?
Oh, absolutely. So the Hurricane Hunters or aircraft run by both NOAA and the United States Air Force. And for Melissa, they actually based out of the small Caribbean island of Curacao. And even before Melissa was named a tropical storm, they were conducting surveillance flights into it to see how strong it was. And those continued all the way up through landfall in Jamaica and even afterward before it made landfall in Cuba. But Hurricane Hunter planes do not fly while the storm is over any land areas out of safety concerns. And the Hurricane Hunters collected some pretty remarkable data on the storm, not only with how strong it was, 892 millibars, as you mentioned, but actually on Tuesday morning before landfall, they released an instrument called a drop sonde. And it's kind of like a reverse weather balloon, where with a weather balloon, we take weather instruments, we put it on a balloon, and it goes up through the atmosphere. Well, in this case, we're dropping these things out of a plane, only instead of putting a balloon on the instrument, we put a parachute on there so it slows the descent. And one of these drop sondes measured a wind gust of 252 miles per hour at an altitude of only 650 feet above the ocean surface. Now, that number is preliminary and, like a lot of the data collected, subject to quality control. And also, even though this is radio, some of the pictures that those brave flight crews took during their missions crossing into the eye of the storm. You're going through the eye wall, you see absolutely nothing except gray, and then in 5 seconds you come out into this bright, sunny eye with this sunlit white wall of clouds surrounding you. The photos and the video of that, I think, are the best I've ever seen from any hurricane, and it adds to that mix of emotions you see of the awe and wonder of how the atmosphere can make storms like this, and then the dread and the foreboding for the poor people in the path.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that's remarkable now in the social media era is that we get a lot of this stuff in near real time. And, you know, seeing the posted images of the crew getting thrown around and the drop sondes actually getting tossed onto the floor
right.
is pretty dramatic. And, of course, in terms of, you know, you, Jeff, I know you watch these storms very closely. What was your reaction and your feeling when you saw that 252 gust?
Wow. I mean, I had to be floored by that because you've never seen a gust anywhere close to this that strong. Now, Melissa was not measured as having sustained winds of 252 miles an hour. That's a 1 second gust. And hurricane intensity is actually measured based on the 1 minute average sustained wind speed. And you also mentioned them getting bounced around. I know there's video footage of at least one meteorologist on board a plane throwing up, going through the eye wall. And then two missions actually had to be aborted due to severe turbulence, both in the eye wall and in the eye. Because these fly at about an altitude of 3,000 meters or about 10,000 feet. Getting any lower than that, the winds are actually a bit stronger in hurricanes, and it won't take much to have an adverse event down on the ocean surface.
One thing that's really interesting about doing hurricane flights is, you know, I get asked a lot in my experience with doing it, is you have to keep in mind that the plane is largely either going directly with or against the wind. And hurricanes, most of their violence is in that horizontal wind flow. So as long as you're going along with it, there's not that big of a deal. Typically, when a hurricane has a really balanced, really well-organized flow, it doesn't have a lot of turbulence in vertical, which is what we experience as turbulence. But when a storm is undergoing something like a rapid intensification, that flow becomes more unbalanced, and you start to see a lot more of those intense vertical motions, and that is the kind of turbulence that you tend to see, and those are the kinds of incidents that send a flight crew back to base because the plane has been overstressed.
And of course, when you're going through the eye wall, you're also experiencing a good amount of crosswinds there as well.
Yeah. It's an intense experience doing a eye wall penetration for sure, but it's kind of fun too.
Yeah, I can imagine in a meteorologist type of way for sure. So Deanna, we know that the Caribbean gets a lot of these storms, and it's one of the more common places that get struck by these types of storms, but how resilient are the communities in, say, Jamaica, Haiti, and Cuba that experience a lot of the damage here to these types of events?
Well, when we think about how we define resilience, we're typically thinking about three things. There's the resilience of the environment to be able to bounce back. And so, for example, if you have pollution that's released in terms of the flooding or things like that, that can damage something ecologically. So that's one thing we think about. The second is the infrastructure that may be damaged by the storm. And so this could be roads, bridges, airports, water systems, all those types of things that we rely upon. And the third thing is the social organization. And so that's going to be getting people out of harm's way, providing them services after the fact. And the reality is that all of the nations in the Caribbean vary wildly in terms of those three factors. And so, for example, with Cuba, Cuba has a very well-organized system of evacuating people and also providing for social services. And so even though their infrastructure may be a bit weaker, they have the social organization to help get people out of harm's way. And then Haiti, on the flip side, especially given a lot of its more social stress that has been undergoing politically and economically, tends to be quite a bit lower on the resilience side of things, exactly because a lot of the social organization and the infrastructure as well haven't been able to keep up with some of the damage that it's experienced, both from hurricanes and other natural hazards over a recent decade. Jamaica's about in the middle between the two, in where they have a fair amount of economic resources and pretty solid infrastructure, but there's also a wide disparity in the kind of resilience that the communities face, either owing to their economic situation or the type of infrastructure that they have. And so there's some pretty significant disparities on the island.
Right. Yeah, to put that in perspective, they still don't have the final death toll for Melissa, but it's at least 75. And right now, 34 of those confirmed in Haiti and 35 in Jamaica. And Jamaica had it far worse in terms of direct impacts from Melissa than Haiti did.
This is Weather Realness, and we've been talking about the destruction of Hurricane Melissa with Deanna Hentz and Jeff Frame, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So it seems like we were fortunate that the storm actually hit the western part of Jamaica that may have been less populated, but unfortunately that part of the island also seemed to have some less resilience in terms of infrastructure.
Yeah, Kingston, the capital, is in the southeast. And if you took this and moved it 50 miles east, it would be even a much greater disaster than it was. But communities like St. Elizabeth Parish, Black River, a town called White House, Mandeville, and then on the northwest coast, Montego Bay, which some of you may know is a big resort community, those areas were impacted pretty badly from this storm.
And one thing that's also interesting, too, especially in the case of Haiti, is that, again, the ecology of a particular area can play an important role. One thing that Haiti has experienced over recent decades is a lot of deforestation on their mountainous hillsides. And so that makes a lot of the area much more prone to landslides than what you would even see on the other half of the island, the Dominican Republic. And so these are the kinds of things that can reduce an area's resilience to these types of storms.
We mentioned earlier that there were some records that were set with this particular storm. Where does Melissa stand in the record books so far?
Yeah, this is all preliminary and subject to review. And what do I mean by that? Well, the Hurricane Center every winter goes back and looks through the storms of the previous season and puts together what's called the best track and the likely intensity at each time during a storm's life cycle. So, for example, if you wonder what people do at the National Hurricane Center in January, they do that. They also do take some vacation time, because if you work at the National Hurricane Center, you actually can't take a vacation in September during the month of hurricane season. So that aside, as you mentioned at the outset, Melissa preliminarily has the third lowest pressure on record in the Atlantic Basin. That's a tie with the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, which hit the Florida Keys. That was before we named hurricanes, at 892 millibars, and also tying that storm with the lowest landfall pressure in the Atlantic at 892 millibars. The two storms that were stronger than Melissa were Hurricane Wilma in 2005 and Hurricane Dorian in 2019.
So, Deanna, what would it have been like to experience the storm in western Jamaica?
One thing that's really important to keep in mind is that these storms are hundreds of kilometers wide. And so you see this steady ramp up over a long period of time of increasing in both the rainfall and an increase in the winds. And that increase in the winds can also come with increases in storm surge as well. But one thing that was really interesting and particularly devastating about Hurricane Melissa is that Hurricane Melissa is also incredibly slow moving. And so that it's gradual ramp up of the severity of the conditions of the wind starting to build, the rainfall starting to get heavier, the seas beginning to rise, happened over many more hours than what would typically happen with a hurricane moving at a more average pace. So the length of time that people experienced those conditions, and importantly, the length of time that the structures also experienced those conditions, was just increased because of that very slow motion.
Right. And it's also important to keep in mind that when you see the storm on the satellite, not everywhere on that satellite is going to get those 100-plus mile-an-hour winds. That's going to be a very small area around the center. So let's say Hurricane Melissa tracked up I-57 here in Illinois. Champaign, Urbana, Savoy, yeah, we'd see heavy devastation in these communities. But if you just go over, say, to Bloomington or to Danville, less than an hour's drive away, it would have been a lot more like a bad summer thunderstorm instead of a catastrophic hurricane that we would have seen along I-57.
Yeah, I think we saw that in Jamaica. For example, Kingston had relatively mild damage from the winds, at least. And then you come over towards the center and it was quite devastating.
Right.
But one thing that is important to keep in mind is that it can be like a bad thunderstorm. But imagine that extremely bad thunderstorm for 10, 12, 18 hours. So the kinds of rainfall that can generate from these storms can expand hundreds of kilometers out from the center. And so when we think about the range of impacts, there is a lot, tends to be a lot of focus on the winds for understandable reasons, because they are very damaging. However, the precipitation is a separate impact that sometimes doesn't get as much attention as it deserves.
And that's a very good point, because something like 75% of all recent hurricane deaths are due to flooding from either storm surge or inland freshwater flooding. And Haiti didn't experience hurricane force winds at all. And the deaths there are almost all due to flooding and mudslides. It's always the water, not the wind. That's a very good point.
How much warning did the local residents get in Jamaica?
Yeah, they got quite excellent warning to get out of the way and to prepare. The storm, like I said, was first became a tropical storm on October 21st. That same day, a hurricane watch was issued for part of Haiti. And then a hurricane watch was issued for Jamaica on October 23rd. That's 4 days before landfall. And then that was upgraded to a hurricane warning on October 24th, 3 days before landfall. And similarly, Cuba and the Bahamas and Bermuda, which got sideswiped, also saw warnings out 2 to 3 days before the storm arrived.
Yeah, initially there was some disagreement amongst the models. There were some that were taking it further towards the east, and then there was another group of models which increasingly became favored and then finally converged on that. So in some cases, this was a little bit of a tricky storm because it kind of made a 90-degree turn in the middle of its track. But overall, it seems like the National Hurricane Center was on top of that information.
Yeah, it was a tricky track forecast. And then on top of that, because the environment, the wind shear, for example, can vary spatially around the area. And of course, if the storm moves over land, it's going to weaken. It's one of those things where the intensity forecast also depends on the track. And I guess one silver lining, too, is that a couple models were showing the storm stalling just off the coast of Jamaica, which in terms of flooding would have been absolutely catastrophic. It was bad enough as it was, but the storm, fortunately, when it did the little stall before landfall, was 100 or so miles south of the island.
That's one thing that's really worth pointing out here, is that when we see these projections of where these storms are likely to go, graphic that's known as the cone of uncertainty. That's only telling you where they think the center of the storm is going to go and how big the area of that cone around the center forecasted track is a way of trying to represent how much certainty there is in the track's likely path. And so when it's really small and narrow, that means that there's a higher level of certainty around that forecast. If it's wider, then there's meaning there's more uncertainty about where the storm was to go. And at the time before Melissa made landfall, there's pretty much a circle around the storm's location because the uncertainty at that time was very high.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Steve Nesbitt, sitting in for Maddie Stover this week. Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness at illinois.edu.
It was the strongest storm to ever hit Jamaica, leaving streets submerged, homes destroyed, and 77% of the island without power.
A lot of my friends' house is gone. Nice, nice home.
We are in Catherine Hall in Montego Bay, not too far from the sea, and this entire area was ravaged by Hurricane Melissa. They had flooding and now the residue of mud up and down the streets.
Before the storm hit Cuba, over 700,000 people took shelter, and just a brave few ventured out today to witness the storm for themselves.
It was hell all night. The winds have been terrible.
So we're just on the outskirts of Santiago de Cuba, and we've come across several scenes like this one, whole orchards of bananas that have just been flat. And this is a big problem for Cuba, which does not produce enough food for its people.
Haiti was spared a direct hit, but one coastal mayor said people were killed in floods after a river burst its banks. Residents in the already impoverished nation now do their best to stay dry, like Francine Louis-Jean.
I am living with the kids. I have nothing to give them. We wake up in the water, we sleep in the water.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio posted online that the U.S. sent supplies, rescue, and response teams to the affected areas. But for many in the region, help may come too little and too late.
This is Weather Realness, and we've been talking about the destruction of Hurricane Melissa with Deanna Hentz and Jeff Frame, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So now that this is an event in the recent past, looking back, what's going on in Jamaica right now? Has there been a strong response, and how are people doing there? What does power look like? Deanna, what is your read on this?
Well, as you can imagine, there's many areas of the island that have been devastated by the storm, and there has been a race to rebuild the airport to get it operational to receive relief flights. There's been clearing of roads. Some roads were washed away, and so figuring out how to reach especially more remote communities, especially in some of the more mountainous areas, and also the communities that were cut off with flooding. As I am able to find information about what's going on right now, it seems like the power outages, which was originally somewhere between 70% and 80% of the island, was without power. That's now reduced to about less than 50%. But I imagine that that is highly variable depending on where you are within the island. There have been a lot of reports of people feeling fairly desperate in terms of searching for food, clean water, and other necessities. And so there has been attempts to get relief into these various areas, but that's going to be determined in coming days in terms of getting roads open, getting, you know, things airlifted in, these kinds of operations that's being coordinated by numerous agencies, both within Jamaica and also through the international community.
Yeah, I think one of the things we saw even in Florida with Hurricane Milton is that even if the power comes on, you have to have a structure that's able to accept that power. And sometimes that can drag on for getting inspections and equipment and materials for weeks and weeks. Mm. And in extreme cases like Hurricane Maria, I mean, some places it took a year to even get power restored. And so that can be a big challenge for local residents. Jeff, what about the international response in terms of financial aid?
Yeah, the United States Department of State has launched an official disaster response. So we're sending some aid and some ships and supplies to the agency through the U.S. federal government. Many other nations are as well around Latin America and Europe and elsewhere. Also, numerous charities and other non-governmental organizations are deploying folks to the island now that the Kingston Airport's been taking flights now for several days. The Montego Bay Airport was quite a bit more badly damaged up on the northwest side of the island. And as these teams get in there, I heard one of the first convoys of relief going into the hardest hit areas was averaging 1 mile per hour because they were literally having to take chainsaws and cut their way through down trees that were clogging roads and highways, to say nothing of the ones that were washed out. And Jamaica, just last year, and this is the first time in history that a Caribbean country has done this, they took out a $150 million catastrophe bond. So you can think of that as like insurance, where they pay so much for this bond. And then if the criteria to pay the bond hits, they get $150 million. And that was financed through the private company Aon and also the World Bank. And the criterion for the bond to pay was to have a hurricane make landfall in Jamaica with a pressure below 900 millibars, which Melissa almost certainly was. And the first payment on that is due in about a month.
So that's some pressure on making sure that their finances are resilient, which is probably not what they want to be worried about right now. But
right. And it's in contrast to a place like the United States, where if Florida gets hit, right, that's still a very small part of the United States because it's such a big country. Whereas here, you know, you're talking about, you know, serious impacts in 25% or more of the land area. You know, if you compare that to the United States, I mean, that would be huge, just massive. And fortunately, storms like that are just not that big geographically.
To you both, looking ahead, what does the rebuilding process look like for Jamaica at this point?
It's going to be a combination of several factors. As we mentioned, getting a lot of the critical infrastructure back online to just even get materials, resources to the people and the places that have been affected is going to take several weeks or months or sometimes years, depending on both the level of damage and also the remoteness of the infrastructure that's involved. Then there's also the process of rebuilding back some of the elements of the economy that have been hit. And so one thing that's an interesting impact that I read about was that this was the time of year that some of the harvest for the winter tourism season was due to happen. And a lot of those crops were lost. And so this is going to be a significant impact for Jamaica's agricultural community, and that is one of their biggest economic activities outside of tourism and mining. This is not just a one crop loss situation. There's also things like contamination of soil or water. There's various things that have to be rebuilt. And so this is typically a very long multi-year process in terms of getting everything back online to where people can resume the activities that they're used to be able to do.
Jeff, right. Anything to add?
Yeah, and if you want to help out, best way is to either find a legitimate charity here based in the United States, or the government of Jamaica has actually set up an official website to donate. That website is supportjamaica.gov.jm. Now, right after the storm hit, there were unfortunately some fraudsters who registered scam websites, but most of those now have been taken down and actually redirect to that official website. But please make sure you're giving money to a legitimate organization. And again, supportjamaica.gov.jm is the official website for the Jamaican government.
Of course, here the Red Cross is a good option for people to go with something that they know.
Right, that as well. And also anyone down there will tell you the best thing you can give is money. You know, not food or not, you know, you go up to Walmart and you buy one package of diapers. Well, they're able to buy hundreds of packs of diapers at a lot cheaper rate than that, and then, of course, not have to pay to ship one thing down there. So money, by far, the best way you can help out.
Yeah, this is actually something that's really interesting, and we've seen this within hurricane responses here in this country, where sometimes relief organizations get flooded with in-kind donations of things like food, diapers, etc. But all of those things require storage. They require the logistics of distributing that. And they have a much easier time organizing that themselves than having to deal with, you know, thousands of small shipments. And so, as mentioned, the Red Cross is a good organization. And I'm looking at the supportjamaica.gov.jm website right now. The Salvation Army is also listed at that. And those are just a couple of maybe more familiar for Americans charities that are involved in this relief effort. And there's several others as well. So again, reiterating that it's really important to contribute to legitimate charities in these situations, because unfortunately scams do have a tendency to pop up in the wake of these types of events.
This is Weather Realness, and we've been talking about the destruction of Hurricane Melissa with Deanna Hentz and Jeff Frame, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So I think we'll wrap up here with the million-dollar question. A lot of people are interested in understanding how climate change impacts hurricanes, and there's a lot of layers to this question, and we'll try to peel back a few of them here today. But what can you say, Jeff, from a meteorologist's perspective about how climate change impacted Melissa?
Right. Good question, Steve. And this is one where you'll read a lot of takes on it out there. And I'm going to try to give you the best I can do based on the current state of the science. And this is research conducted by the Yale Climate Connections Group and the Imperial College at London, who were two legitimate academic organizations studying climate and how climate might affect individual weather events. And they found that the winds were made probably set around 7% more intense, although there's a little bit of variability in that number. And because the damage actually goes not linearly with the wind speed, the damage might have been up to 12% more intense. So you're still talking about a catastrophic storm. It was just made that much worse by this, and that's likely due to the warming of the atmosphere and the warming of the ocean, providing the storm with more energy, as Deanna discussed. Now, some of the headlines out there you have to be a little careful with. For example, I saw one today, climate change made Melissa four times more likely. Now, I think what that means is it made a storm of Melissa's intensity four times more likely to hit. Did it make a hurricane four times more likely to hit Jamaica in the month of October? Absolutely not. Climate change doesn't cause hurricanes. It doesn't cause disasters. What it does is it influences the background state of the atmosphere, making things more or less likely, making storms stronger or maybe sometimes weaker.
Deanna, we've heard in previous episodes that climate change and global warming increases the amount of water vapor that the atmosphere can hold. We've been told that about 7% more water vapor per degree Celsius of warming is what we can expect. How does that play into some of the damage that we saw in Melissa?
Well, one thing that's really important to keep in mind here is that we're talking about a storm that is already incredibly good at making precipitation, but it's also relying upon that moisture being in the air to be available for it to then turn into precipitation. And so what climate change could be possibly contributing to this is making more moisture available in the atmosphere for the storm to use in this very efficient way. So when we think about the impacts of Melissa and how climate change influenced that, when you're talking about 7% additional of rainfall, when you're already talking about 40 plus inches of rain, I'm not sure that additional 7% is making anything even more catastrophic than it already is, because we're kind of already in the ridiculous territory.
Right. So, of course, the intensity of This also relates to the ocean as well. And we know that the oceanic heat content under Melissa was almost off the charts. And so that's another thing that we need to study probably more in the future, is how the ocean and the atmosphere interact, which is turns out to be a really complicated thing to model.
Yeah, and one thing that's really interesting about that is we talked about that depth of warmth into the ocean. One reason why this is interestingly important in Melissa is because Melissa was so slow moving. Normally, when a storm is that slow and moving, it's churning up the ocean underneath it, and it begins to mix cold water that's farther into the ocean's depth up to the surface, and that can actually start to choke the hurricane off from its energy source. But if that well of warm water goes very deep into the ocean, then it can sit in the same place and keep churning and churning and still maintain that source of energy because that source of water goes so deep. And so this is another interesting impact that requires a lot more study, is these hurricanes that are more stationary but are also over these really deep wells of warm water, and what kind of impact that can have in terms of how they evolve, how the storms evolve.
Yeah, it's like driving a race car, but the gas pump is still connected.
So exactly.
You can keep going at high speed and never run out of gas. This is Weather Realness, and we've been talking about the destruction of Hurricane Melissa with Deanna Hentz and Jeff Frame, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much, Deanna and Jeff, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you, Steve. And I'll end with a little bit of good news that we're almost near the end of hurricane season here. It's becoming increasingly unlikely for a major hurricane to strike the United States, but it does run through the end of November, with most of those impacts, again, being in Central America and the Caribbean again.
That's good news. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Steve Nesbitt, sitting in for Maddie Stover this week. Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Coming up next, we're talking about climate change and hurricanes even further. What do we know and what to expect about the hurricanes of the future?